Today you're going to hear the first part of a modern-day fairy tale about how a girl from the troubled north of Ireland, who married into a fifth-generation French ribbon dynasty, did her part to save her husband's family business of making exquisite ribbons on 19th-century jacquard looms, and in the process saved herself. I'm Judy Stewart, and you're listening to Unpaused, a podcast for women who want to stage a career comeback or mastermind a new one after an extended break from work. Madame Ruth Ribicourt today isn't such a different woman from the dynamic Miss Ruth Bradley of the early 2000s. Back then, Ruth thought she'd found her perfect niche as marketing director of Disney in Ireland, honing her skills in communications, PR, and brilliant people managing, all of which came easily to her. She was a natural. Ruth didn't just love her job. The people she worked with in this tight-knit community became her second family. They'd seen her mature as a professional. They'd come to her wedding, rejoiced when she became a new mother. They were everything to her. And then came a shocking pause. Exhausted returning to work, despite an extended maternity leave, she was diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease, an autoimmune disorder which attacks your thyroid gland, the gland that coordinates many of the body's essential functions. Left untreated, it can lead to serious heart problems, severe depression, and profound lethargy. As she absorbed her diagnosis, Ruth felt she had no choice but to resign and really focus on getting well. Meanwhile, the global financial crisis had hit Ireland hard, and she and her financier husband, a Frenchman, made the move to La Coste, a small village in Provence. Without a driver's license or even a mobile phone, she was stranded for long hours with a young baby in a foreign country, her friends far away, as she came to grips with managing a body that couldn't always keep up. Ruth says she walked out of the world of blockbuster cinema to the edge of an abyss. Before long, she was experiencing the crippling sense that the most significant job of her life was behind her. However, what followed was a moment that could have been written by Walt Disney himself. You'll have to listen to all of this if the thought of a treasure trove of gold and silver ribbons made on 19th century looms and supplying the haute couture houses of Paris and Milan sends tingles down your spine. This is a long interview that we've split into two parts. Ruth tells her story in long form, how she goes from marketing for Disney in Ireland to founding the French Muse, her experiential retreat program in southern Provence, is truly inspiring. I have to warn you though, you won't hear much from me. Ruth's a born storyteller, perhaps it's her Irish genes. Ruth weaves the tale of her need to know everything about the fragile family ribbon business so that she could help to save it from the threat that the new age industrial needle ribbon looms presented. Then there's the almost magnetic pull of the weekend brocante, the flea markets in southern France, and the hidden ateliers of the Provençal artists she soon found and befriended. This is a wonderful tale of career self-help and renewal that I hope will delight you as much as it did me. Here's part one of the story of Ruth Ribicourt.
The French Muse was something that I created as an experience based on my coming to France and starting from scratch and just meeting people, discovering artists, discovering handmade, discovering the heritage goods in France and makers. And I suppose the way that my life blossomed and I nurtured my creative side, and I wanted to be able to create an experience that would, even just for a small amount of time, allow travelers to live that life that I have lived in Provence. I felt that this is something that a lot of people would want to experience as well, to meet the artists of Provence and to step inside private homes and see how people live with antiques and textiles and color and history. And so the French Muse came about as a way of introducing travelers who are maybe a little bit weary and in need of nourishment and inspiration and creativity. So I grew up in Northern Ireland, in the middle of the Troubles. I actually went to boarding school in the Republic of Ireland so that I could kind of escape what was going on in the North. And when I was about 12, 1992, my mother opened a contemporary art gallery. She's a speech therapist by profession, but she'd always wanted to do something in the arts. It was the first art gallery at the time that would have art exhibitions with artists across the border from both Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which seems ridiculous today, but at the time it was quite a new thing. We lived in the north of Ireland, and my father and my mother had their work, the gallery, and my father's surgery was in a small border town called Dundalk in County Louth. And so this for me was such an exciting environment to suddenly be kind of thrown into. And, you know, my mother would host exhibitions, I think it was nearly one every 6 weeks. And so I would come off the bus on a Friday night from boarding school. I'd arrive into Dundalk and I would be given a tray with glasses of wine to serve to all these glamorous art buyers. And afterwards, we would all go for dinner with the artists and their family. And it was quite an extraordinary experience to grow up in the middle of that, to have a seat at that table, literally, and to see the art world from the inside.
And did you get a sense, Ruth, that you would want to be an artist?
I had always been creative. You could always find me in my bedroom tinkering around with some beads. Or I think growing up in that situation with mature artists who had really struggled for quite a long time to be recognized, it made me very nervous about going into study art in art college. And I did flirt with the idea, but just part of me, I just didn't want to be mediocre, and I didn't know that I had this kind of sheer talent that I felt was necessary to be an artist. And so I chickened out. I actually studied business at Trinity College Dublin. So I went the complete other direction. I had studied for my leaving certificate. I had studied all of the sciences, maths, applied maths, and I had also studied art. But for some reason, I just didn't think I had what I thought was necessary to be this success in art college. So I went to study business. And I felt like I floated through college because it wasn't really me. And I knew it wasn't me. I knew I could do it and I could pass all the exams, but I felt like I was just doing the motions. I was getting the real degree in inverted commas, you know, that my parents were proud to tell people about. And, you know, I was going to make something of myself. I did a third year in France with the Erasmus program. And then I had this week-long placement in Paris as part of that university year, and it was about management of cultural institutions. And up until then, I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do when I graduate? I don't want to work in a bank. It seems very silly now in hindsight, but suddenly we spent a week with film producers. We spent a week at the Louvre learning about the marketing of the Louvre Gallery in Paris. So I was introduced to the other side of business, the business of the arts. And it was a light bulb moment for me. And I thought, wow, okay, I can still work on a business side of things. I can still work in a creative capacity. And up until that point, which was 3 years in university, I hadn't heard once that that was an option.
Yeah. So it was really engaging both sides of the brain that were both obviously very, very talented. And if I could just fast forward you there, Ruth, to your role at Disney, you ended up being part of the marketing team for Disney in Ireland.
So the day after my graduation, I decided I was going to make it happen for myself. And so I stormed up to the front door of the Walt Disney Studios motion pictures office in Dublin. I had no interview. I had research that the head of marketing was this woman called Trish Long. I said, I think Trish Long will want to speak to me. I said, and there was a little bit of a nervous pause on the other end of the phone. And a long story short, I didn't get to see Trish Long that day, but I was invited to come back for a proper interview. I convinced them to give me an internship. And I was there for 3 months. I didn't have a desk or anything. I was getting tea and I was sticking down press cuttings and I was making myself completely indispensable to anybody that needed help. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time when the marketing assistant in that job for Walt Disney was headhunted for another role. And so I threw my hat in the ring for it. And I know ordinarily if I had done that as an outsider, I wouldn't even have made it past the interview process. But because I had shown, you know, what I was capable of.
And built some nice relationships, Ruth, as well.
Well, yes. I mean, they could see that, you know, I was a go-getter, that I was young, but that I really wanted to do it. I had initiative and that I'm a people person. I love communicating. So they saw me in action. I just absolutely loved that role. I started out as marketing assistant and a very small team. So everything was in-house. You could hear what was going on in the sales department and you could see the relationships that were being, deals were being signed with young filmmakers. And we would distribute certain Irish films from script stage onwards until the theatrical release. It was basically the film distribution end. So all the movies that were going into cinema, I was in charge of the marketing and publicity campaigns to launch the movie in cinema. So I went from marketing assistant to worked my way up to marketing manager, so marketing and publicity. I was then asked to work as part of the international team. And really, that was something that my boss, Trish Long, championed me for. When a movie is released in cinema, there is an international publicity campaign with tour stops along the way. And it's always London, for example, Madrid, Rome, Amsterdam. It will change, but it basically I would be the point person for Disney and a talent handling. So I would be accompanying an actor or a director or a producer, and I would be their point of contact during that entire publicity tour. And so it called on key communication skills, neurolinguistic programming. And it was such a phenomenal experience. And I learned an incredible amount on that job, working with an international team, problem solving, scheduling. I was just in my element. Somewhere along the way, I met my husband, Raphael, a Frenchman.
He was working there.
It's a funny story. My mother set us up. It was an arranged marriage. When we met, he was living in France. And then he moved to Ireland and we lived together for 4 years. And we got married very quickly. I was pregnant very quickly. Our little Louis was born in 2009. And that really changed. I hadn't really ever considered getting married. I hadn't considered motherhood. They weren't really priorities for me until they were in my life as such. And when my son Louis arrived, I just felt everything shifted for me. My boss negotiated a fantastic 6-month maternity leave for me, which gave me so much time with my son. And around the time that I was going from maternity leave to work, I discovered that I had a very serious illness, Hashimoto's, and it's an autoimmune disease where your immune system is attacking the thyroid gland, which at the time I didn't realize how sick I was, but I had just put it down to having a newborn and being
exhausted.
Very, very tired. And don't get me wrong, I was so excited to go back to work. Yeah. I loved my son, but I was so excited to get back into it because I really, really loved that job. I got this diagnosis and it was pretty serious, but I didn't have any real chance to take the time off that I needed to take off to get better, because I was going back in. I think we were releasing a very big blockbuster, and you know, it was like all action back at the office. So I started on the medication, and I did find myself getting a little bit better, but it just, something just felt a little bit off. And I, you know, at the same time, this is back in 2010, the economic crisis was hitting Ireland in a very dramatic way. And my husband, who works in finance, was being moved from a, you know, a full-time week to a three-day week. And there was a lot of turmoil, a lot of not knowing would he have the job at the end of the month. And it put a lot of pressure on us, both my being sick and the uncertainty for his work. And I found myself about 3 months after going back to work, I found myself up in my boss's office. And I don't think I've ever felt so ill, trying to find the words to say, I'm leaving my job, because this was, for me, this was a family. All my team and my boss had come to my wedding. You know, they had seen me growing up from 23 years old, straight out of college, right up until getting married and having my first child. And it was a really big deal to say that I was going to have to leave that job. And I just felt, I think my personality is as if I can't do something absolutely to the best of my ability, I get really hard on myself. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to give it as much as I wanted to give it with my health issues and having a little baby at home who needed me as well. So
it was an all or nothing thing. It was you were either in or you were 100% out.
Yeah. I mean, the Disney, it's a phenomenal job, but it's very intense. My husband is French. We had always talked about moving to France. It felt like we were being pushed in that direction. You know, when you have to step back and just listen to the signs. And I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe this is the moment that we take a step off the ladder and slow down a bit, you know, and just enjoy life. And I always thought in the back of my mind that I would go back to it, that I would just, you know, maybe have another child and then go back working for the Walt Disney office in Paris. It was like, oh, we'll just take 6 months off the ladder, slow down, get better, and then I'll go start looking for the new job. And it didn't quite happen that way, unfortunately.
Well, I've read somewhere that you described leaving Disney as stepping off the career ladder into an abyss.
The truth of the matter, I mean, we live in one of the most beautiful parts of the world. It's where people dream, and you know, it's where people dream of living. But for me to leave a career that I loved, I was the breadwinner at the time. So to leave the potential to contribute, the power to contribute in a marriage and in a family, to leave that in November to move to a tiny village where everything was shuttered up for 3 months. I didn't have a driving license. I had a one-year-old. I left everything behind me. I was kind of buoyed up on the excitement of it all and getting the house sorted and getting the utility bills in order and everything. But once all that initial excitement died away, I did find myself thinking, wow, that was it. That was it for me. That was all I had to contribute. I'm never going to get a job again. It was really very terrifying. My confidence was shattered as a process of that. When we moved to France, I didn't have a mobile phone for a year and a half. I just thought, well, nobody needs to get me except my mother-in-law, and my mother lives up the road. So, you know, I don't need to be contactable. I really went completely in the other direction. I went walking every day.
But in terms of your mental health, it was a big pause.
I was so defeated. I was really paralyzed with this fear, and I just thought that's it now. That was my moment. 8 years working for Walt Disney, and that was it. And I couldn't see how I could get another job in definitely not in the same industry in this area. That if I wanted to work, I would have to create something for myself, because that was the only way.
I can't tell you the number of women who've said that to me, including, and in fact, I've said it myself, if I wanted something, I would have to create it for myself. So, Ruth, I know this story has such a good twist in it, and I want to get into it because it's the thing I'm really fascinated by.
So the twist.
The twist,
so,
yes. Yeah. You had unknowingly married into a ribbon dynasty.
Yes. So when I was in Ireland, I did not know cotton from linen. My knowledge of textiles was so incredibly limited. And so when we moved to France that first winter, we spent Christmas up with my parents-in-law who live near Lyon, which is the silk capital of France. Over the Christmas period, we went over to see my husband's grandparents, Mam and Papi Georgie. And just without any kind of introduction, they opened this cupboard, and inside this cupboard were these shelves and shelves and shelves of old books. And they took a book down, and each family member took a book down. We were just kind of, it was seemed to be a, like one of their Christmas rituals to go through these books. And they were pages and pages and pages of ribbon samplers. And I thought, wow, this is a strange thing for a family to do at Christmas time. But it became apparent that very quickly that actually these were ribbons that my family had woven, and that my family actually have been making ribbons since 1864. And the other thing, I mean, for me, before I knew anything about the family company, a ribbon for me was something that you wrap a present with. That was the extent of my knowledge. And so I found myself in this ribbon dynasty, one of the only remaining ribbon makers in France. And the family is the Faure family. The family company is called Julien Faure. And today we make ribbons for all of the top haute couture houses: Chanel, Dior, Hermes, Celine, Valentino, Dolce & Gabbana. But we've been making ribbons since 1864. And our family went into the business of ribbon making because at the time, the ribbon was one of the most important elements of fashion. So for women at the time, if they couldn't afford a new dress, they could afford a new ribbon to update their dress. And so my French family were industrialists, and they saw this potential in the ribbon making industry. And they opened a big ribbon making company in a town that used to be known for ribbon making. It's only one of a handful left now making ribbons. So basically what happened on the very first Christmas, I went and I asked my husband's grandmother if she had any ribbons that I could play around with to make some jewelry with. And at the time, I think Lanvin were making these beautiful necklaces with grosgrain ribbon and pearls. And I thought, oh, you know, well, I'll just make myself one of those. Since I don't have a job anymore, I can't buy myself one, so I'll make one. So that was the kind of idea at the back of my mind. And when my husband's grandmother, her name is Mam, she went into the hot corridor and she came back with this little cardboard box. And she said, well, you know, just take a few, don't take too many, you know, see how you go. And if you need more, you know, you can come back to me. And I opened the box up, and I had never seen anything like these ribbons. They were cut velvet, gold, heavily laden with gold and silver thread. And I was overwhelmed. And because I'd asked for this, and I had made all these promises that this is what I was going to do with them, and I felt this responsibility to take them and actually now create something out of them.
And so that's how Ruth began her comeback. Unpaused is a podcast that brings to life real stories of real people who've often had catastrophic pauses but gone on to have wonderful careers. Ruth Ribicourt is almost the perfect example. As you'll hear in the second part of her story next time, everything that had come before, Ruth's artistic spark, the marketing genius, her warmth and skills with people, her doggedness, came into play. At the bottom of everything, though, was her appetite to learn all she could about the heritage and quality of the ribbons and the people of Saint-Étienne who made them. Instinctively, she not only grasped their important role in France's cultural patrimony, but how valuable they could again be to contemporary French fashion. She was determined that they would not disappear, like all the other ribbon makers of Saint-Étienne had, without a fight. And she could have said, yes, but it's my husband's family, not mine. Yes, but it's their heritage, not mine. Yes, but they don't feel comfortable with me asking all these questions, and she could have left it alone. Certainly her questions were not always welcome. But as she tells it, the story of the ribbon set her mind ablaze and little by little revealed a new working life for her, and away she went. If you want to hear what happens next, tune into part two with Ruth next week. You can stay up to date with all the Unpaused stories on our website, unpaused.net, or by following our Instagram account at _unpaused. We also love hearing from you and getting your thoughts on the show, so please leave a comment on Instagram or tag us in your stories and posts. If you'd rather, you can go to the website and leave a voice recording there with any questions you have or comments. Special thanks again to producer Leonie Marsh and to Jason Milhouse for his patience and cleverness in the studio. I couldn't do it without you or you, the listener. Until next time, farewell.